First of all, welcome everybody. I really appreciate all of you putting the time into this. I know how busy everybody is, and it's not a small task to get these things organized when everybody has a full-time job anyway, but hopefully you'll benefit from this. Scott Hazleton, Senior Consultant for Global Insights, Addressing the Construction Issues. Martin Stringfellow from Martin B. Stringfellow Company on FF&E. Mark Woodruff, Executive VP of PKF Consulting, who has helped us a lot with the land pricing and some of the general market oversight. And Jack Corgill from Cornell may be on the call. We're not sure, but if he is, that's great. So if you look at the categories you're directing, it's land, consultants, FF&E, construction, technology, OS&E, and then we'll talk a little bit about contingencies at the end and then what our recommendations are to deal with all this. That's how we're going to approach it. So on the first part, which was what Jack and Mark provided, Mark, could you give us an introduction, explanation, explain how to interpret all the charts that you provided?
Let me speak to the land number first. And my colleague, Jack Corgill, who's the Baker Chair of Real Estate up at Cornell, part of his career-long focus in academia has been this whole issue of his specialization is in real estate and finance. He's an economist by training, but he's been very focused on land pricing and has done a lot of research in land values and pricing and so forth and how it shifted. But what the chart illustrates is the best historical data series that he's been able to come up with and that he feels comfortable represents a meaningful indication of how land prices have changed over time is a farm index that I think comes from the USDA, which basically illustrates year by year how an acre of farmland has changed. And the graph that none of us are looking at right now, but I think clearly illustrates what all of us intuitively have come to know and believe, and that is land prices over the last 3 to 5 years at a minimum have been increasing dramatically. And so again, even though this represents farmland, Jack does believe it's a meaningful proxy for how commercial and residential land values have been growing as well. As the rest of you probably know better than I do, that typically the land component of a ground-up development is going to be anywhere from 10 to 20% of the overall project cost. So the fact that that sizable element has been escalating dramatically of late certainly has been one of the contributors to this what appears to be a fairly formidable barrier to meaningful levels of new construction surfacing. On the slide that we do have today, we pulled some data from the Bureau of Labor Statistics that tracks they actually track it on it's an index on a monthly basis that we've converted to quarterly values that going back to 1987 as a base year show the quarter-to-quarter change in some of the key components to commercial construction, those being materials for construction, a general category, and then lumber, iron and steel, and then products that come from steel mills. We've imposed on that graphic the quarter-to-quarter change in available supply here in the U.S. And importantly, the supply line there represents what occurred in the top 52 largest hotel markets in the U.S. That data begins in 1987, thus that's why we've indexed all of the data to that point in time. And importantly, in explaining the supply line graphic, there's a horizontal blue line growing across the middle that represents what the average annual supply growth has been over that period of time. And interesting enough, within the top 52 largest hotel markets, that number is right at 2.5% per year over this 18 or 19 year period. The line that you see here moving from left to right illustrates what the actual change in available supply was that year relative to the 2.5% average. Did that make any sense, what I just said?
Mark, I don't understand. The numbers on the left side of the chart are different than the numbers on the right. What do they mean?
They're basis point variation from the index.
Does that mean that supply is actually relatively going down?
No, what that means is, and it's there's two things going on here. The construction data is indexed to the axes on the left. If you look at the far left side where all the data starts, that's right at 100. Okay, so it's in with 1987 being equal to 100. So then as we move from left to right over time, that's how the index for each of those four categories has moved relative to the 1987 price.
Okay, and then on the left?
Oh, that is the left. On the right, that is the annual change in room supply index.
Okay.
I'm now looking at the right-hand axis where it says 100.
Yeah.
That represents the long-term average annual change in supply, which, as an aside, is 2.5% per year. So therefore, when the blue line is above the blue horizontal line, that means supply is increasing at a rate higher than the long-term average. And when the blue line is below the horizontal blue line, it means supply is changing at a rate below the long-term average. So
Okay, so now we're below the long-term average.
right. So as we look at the data, what it illustrates is if we look back to the early 90s, when we were both recovering from the building boom of the late 80s, and that's where you see the blue line being well above the horizontal line.
Right.
So it was a combination of we were recovering from that dramatic supply growth period and also recovering from the recession and the first Gulf War of the 1990-1991 period. So it took the first half of the 1990s for the industry to get back to a development pace that equaled the long-term average of 2.5% per year.
Right.
Then for the back half of the 1990s, where you see again the blue line moving well above the horizontal blue line, that was the market's response to growing profits, increased property values, and as you can see, at least for two of the indicators there, iron and steel and steel mill products, there were actually declines in those pricing in the back half of the 1990s.
Yeah.
But then by 1999, people were figuring out that maybe we're building too much, maybe the economy's not going to be great forever. Let's begin to throttle back somewhat. And of course, that throttle was really pulled back when the recession began in late 00, early 01, and then of course the events of 9/11 and everything beyond that really saw that the level of supply change drop down to real close to the all-time lows that we saw back in the early 1990s. So again, the way to really interpret that is that there were periods where supply growth was really strong, and there were periods where it got back to almost zero. And you can see that where those cycles fell as we look back over the last 18 years. And importantly, the two things to perhaps walk away from this being, two or three things, is that you can see on the far right-hand bottom corner of the graph that blue line is now starting to tick back up.
Right.
So the momentum is beginning to accelerate. But then importantly, again, if we had the land number to look at, and then if we look at these four other lines that speak to the cost of some of the key construction material components, we see that there's been a dramatic run-up in pricing. So therefore, you guys are the experts, I'm not, but will these construction prices come down? If they don't, what does it mean? I think, if you let me, I'll take the whole hour talking about this
Well,
stuff.
this is great. It's great to see the supply information alongside the construction cost information. That's unusual to see that combined like that.
If there is another graphic, we were to impose on here a line that showed hotel incomes, and what we would see is a dramatic decline in profitability starting in 2001 for all the reasons that we know about, and that has begun, and really in a V-shaped fashion, has been ramping up dramatically the last 2.5 years now. But importantly, in real terms, we don't see property level incomes getting back to their past peak until probably 2010. So in real terms, profitability, we're probably still 3.5 to 4 years away from our past peak. And so we think combination of that, combination of cap rates, which are at historic lows today, are absolutely going to begin creeping up. And again, there's the interest rate growth contributor to that. There's the slowing down of hotel profitability growth. And because of the topic of the day, the belief that somehow construction will be accelerating going forward. And again, this graphic here begins to illustrate that, therefore suggesting higher levels of volatility in the marketplace. Those three factors suggest that cap rates will be trickling up going forward. And so, once again, making it that much more difficult to justify new development.
On Jack's chart, his land price chart, there's dollars, 200, 400, 600 on the left-hand side of the chart. What does that represent?
I'm not 100%. I believe it's dollars per acre.
It'd be great to take your chart and project it another 5 years, just to look at what that would look like.
Well, we charge for that.
Okay.
No, not really. But we do charge for that. But we have the supply number. But what's real interesting, and again, I'll try to be quiet here. But from a forecasting perspective, and we do have these econometrically driven forecasts that for the 52 largest hotel markets in the U.S. One of the challenges right now is there's really no clarity beyond the next couple of years in terms of what's likely to happen with the economy. And so because of that, meaning it, no one has a clear vision, is it going to get a whole lot better or a whole lot worse? The longer range forecasts right now, anyway, pretty well flatten out, which deals with this idea that eventually everything reverts to some kind of mean or long-term average.
Yeah.
So right now, absent a shock to the system, either positive or negative, it's a fairly stable outlook once you get past the next couple of years.
So you guys have actually projected this chart forward?
We have the supply number. We don't do this construction stuff, and I haven't been able to find any forecasts of that.
Well, let's go on to Martin and then Scott, and we'll see if at the end of this, if there's a way together we could all project some prediction. Might be interesting. Anyway, that was great, Mark. Thanks a lot. One quick thing on consultants. We surveyed 1,200 consultants. We got a significant response of 10 or 12%, something like that. Plus, I've had many phone calls with people and talked a lot of other people just informally. So we have, a pretty good sampling. And what was interesting, that 90% of the consulting community has seen no more than a 10 or 15% change in their fee amounts since 2002, and they don't see any more of a change in that going forward the next 2 or 3 years, which I was kind of surprised by. So basically, the consulting category is fairly flat, and there's a few, 10% of the group, I would say, are seeing huge increases, 25, 30%, and they tend to be consultants in places that are on fire, like Washington, D.C., Vancouver, where there's the Olympics going on, or Las Vegas. They tend to be spot market, really isolated examples. So in general, the consulting category is relatively flat and moving up somewhat. And the only thing we can attribute that to is just increased competition. And if you go to the next slide, you'll see a graph. This is the consulting category as a percentage versus total development cost in our business, which is $150 million a year annually capital expended, but representing over $1 billion of capital that's ongoing. So we're in the $1 billion to $1.3 billion range of managed capital right now of all types of projects, from renovations to redevelopment projects to big ground up mixed use projects, internationally in Mexico, Central America, the Caribbean, and North America primarily. So I think it's a pretty good representation, but I think it kind of supports what the other surveys show, that the consulting category is relatively flat. Okay, Martin, then we'll move ahead to yours.
Okay.
Just kind of go through the chart first, if you would.
And not a problem. The chart was developed by me calling three of who I consider the trendsetters or the leaders of the industry in each of the categories, ocean freight, common carrier, carpet, lamp, seating, and case goods, the basic components of the guest room, really not relating much to public areas. Public areas have sort of follow these trends. The rooms obviously represent the meatiest part of any hotel project, so that's where I focused. I was surprised, and I took the chart from baseline being 2000 and then capping it off last year in 2005, and things were driven by three factors. Obviously, petroleum affecting carpet, wall covering, upholstery with the foam, and, of course, freight costs. And steel affecting, you know, seating. Every chair has a frame, a steel frame, basically bed sets with the coils, bed frames, lamps, and refrigerators. And so petroleum, steel, and fast-track schedules. I honestly believe that the fast-track schedules had more push other than, I'd say maybe oil had the biggest push, but other than that, fast-track schedules pushed the prices up faster than everything. I'll explain that in a minute. One interesting note, if you see the pink line, which is the ocean freight line, it had a huge jump from 2000 to 2003. That is when a lot of stuff shifted to China. China's been building for years, of course, but now we're primarily China. Every category is primarily China. And as the demand went up for China, for freight, for ocean freight that is, of course the price went up. It's basically a supply and demand issue. You can also see what happened to the case goods price as it shifted to China, the brown line at the bottom. We had a huge drop. We're paying, in my opinion, less for case goods now than we have in the last 7 or 8 years because of China, because it was U.S.-based and now China-based. Everything else, as you can see, drifted up. Common carrier continues to go up with the fuel prices. And the fuel is not so much related to the cost of point A to point B. Truckload rates, for example, have not gone up. If you're shipping something from St. Louis to Los Angeles, in 2000 it was $1.30 a mile, and in 2006 is projected to be $1.65 a mile. Not that much increase. What has gone up on the fuel are these surcharges. They were 0% fuel surcharge in 2000. Currently, we're at about 25% fuel surcharge this year, established by the government. That's what's getting us is the surcharge.
The surcharge on?
On the fuel rate. In other words, if something is costing $1,000, now it's costing $1,250 or $1,300, depending on the surcharge.
What's the surcharge for?
The surcharge is somehow established by the government as to allow the freight companies to adjust their rates for the cost of fuel.
But don't they just do that in their basic rate? Seems like they're double-dipping.
No, they don't do it in the basic rate. That's what I'm saying. The basic rate from point A to point B has not gone up that much. It's the surcharge that's killing us. And the surcharge, by the way, is also applicable to the ocean freight.
Is the basic rate regulated?
Yes. It's all regulated.
Okay, so the government's pulling the basic rate.
The government's establishing the basic rate and the government's establishing the surcharge, and it's all, I guess, comes out in the wash, but they're allowing them to charge more and more based upon the cost of fuel, and it's in the surcharge.
Right. And that affects the same with ocean freight?
Absolutely.
Why has ocean freight gone down so much then?
Ocean freight has gone down for a couple of reasons. I was really surprised to see that. Biggest reason it's gone down is the super carriers. In 2000, in 1998 and 1999, they were shipping about 2,500 to 3,000 containers per ship. In 2003, they went to super carriers, and they're shipping 10,000 containers per ship. Let's say it's gone from 3,000 to 10,000. So they're getting more containers, more 20-foot containers, if you will, stacked on top of these ships, and the cost has come down somewhat.
You know, one of the other kind of interesting things, we're looking at doing some work in Panama, and they're doubling the capacity of the Panama Canal. One of the reasons is to accommodate these super freighters.
That's right.
Martin, the area outside the Panama Canal, at least on the Pacific side I saw, looked just like Long Beach. It was like 60, 70 ships out there waiting to get in.
You know, I've seen Long Beach that way during the strike. And also, by the way, this jump that you see had to do with the strike. It was an increase in demand and the strike. And, of course, they can, you know, take advantage of the strike situation.
Yeah, how many ships you think on an average day are waiting to get into Long Beach?
You know, that's a good question. I don't know. Just from my personal observation, seemed to be about 10 or 12 out there. During the strike, I saw at least 50.
Yeah. Well, the Panama Canal is interesting because, obviously, it's the shortest route to Europe and China, and it's just like, you know, a freeway on rush hour right now.
Right. What a fantastic opportunity there for Panama.
Yeah.
They absolutely should pursue that, like to invest in the Panama Canal.
Any other thoughts, Martin, on where you see all this stuff going?
I think it's going to continue to go up. I think freight's going to continue to go up. Everyone, a few projected into 06 and 07, and everybody was going up, I would guess, 7 to 10% a year on everything. You'll see China drifting back up now, as you see it as this chart is starting to climb back as the demand has gone up. I think if we can slow down the process, if we can allow the proper lead time, I think we can control that upward trend, and that's what I'm trying to push. If people can start schedules earlier, if you can allow a year for a project to develop the model room and then develop the production run, so there's two actual phases of effort there, the model and then production. But if you can allow a year rather than 10 months or 6 months, I think you'd see prices neutralize. I know people are taking advantage of myself and representing my clients when I call and I say I have to have a model room in 6 weeks, which requires air freight. We have spent upwards of $40,000 to fly over a model room, which costs $40,000.
Yeah, it's crazy.
And so if people can just slow down and think ahead, well, you'd have saved, you know, half the price of the model room. Well, that'll flatten the chart out. And we have flown over projects. I won't mention any names, but around Christmas time, people have to have it by Christmas, and they'll start flying projects over. I'm talking about hundreds of rooms of stuff.
That's crazy.
And so there it goes. There, that chart starts going up. This whole world, this fast food, fast track, fast everything, has probably created more of a monster of inflation than oil.
Well, I think there's something to happen after 2001 where people just have to have everything like instantly anymore.
Knowing that, why not slow down and neutralize it? I did receive a RFP yesterday. They're allowing the proper times. I can't wait to get my hands on it. If you can allow these factories, even in China, they do have some slow period. If you can give them a year to produce it, if you had that kind of time, and allow them to produce during their slower periods, you'll take advantage of that. They'll give you a discount for that.
Let's talk about that when we get to recommendations.
Okay.
Scott, you want to take on your part?
Sure. Well, people expect economists to say on the one hand and on the other, so I will not disappoint. And for looking at building materials forecasts and I guess the near-term outlook, the bad news is that if you paid more for materials in 04 and 05, you're going to pay more again in 06. The good news is that once we get past this year, and start looking at 07 and beyond, things do stabilize a little bit. If you look at slide 12, just to sort of set the tone, the orange line is investment in construction for non-residential buildings, which would include hotels, but also industrial buildings, office buildings, and so forth. And the blue line is, in fact, housing starts. So what you see is that this year is a turning point for housing. The boom is over. It's not quite a bust, but you're going to see a substantial drop-off in residential activity, but yet a fairly strong environment for non-res. That's important, as we'll see in a few minutes here.
Scott, is that mainly single-family housing that's going to be off, or do you see condominiums being off, too?
I think I can see condos are off, too. I mean, it's really a function of affordability.
Right.
Is what's driving this, and I mean, condos are a somewhat cheaper alternative, but I think, and of course, the way the government works and reports data, they report single-family as single-family, but condos and apartments are lumped together.
Okay.
And you really, it's hard on a month-to-month basis to sort that out. You can, over time, go back and extrapolate that, in fact, much of the multifamily housing spending in recent years has been, in fact, condos.
Yeah.
But we'd expect going forward that it's going to become more rentals. So ironically, the total category for multifamily cannot move much but the composition could move quite a bit, and we expect that it's going to be moving towards apartments in the future.
And we're starting several mixed-use developments with a condo component. That's why I'm asking.
Okay. One of the key things in the slide is to take a look at that curve from about 01 to, say, 2002 or 3, and look at 2003 to 2006, and you see there's a world of difference. In the early part of the slide, we have a pretty strong level of non-res growth, low housing. They both move together in that middle section, and then they diverge again out in the later years, and that's really what's going to drive a lot of the forecast for building materials. So if you move to slide 12, this is just a general producer price index for all building materials. And you see a real escalation in prices in 2004 and 5 relative to the overall consumer price index. Modest correction around late in 05, and then certainly recent history, and we expect the future history to be that 06 is going to be higher than the overall price index, but not by as much as you saw in 04 and 05. So to start looking at why we think things are going to start slowing down a little bit in terms of price appreciation, slide 14 is a little confusing in that we're looking at one series, that is the industrial materials price index, which has been lagged for 3 months or one quarter. And we're also looking at the PPI for intermediate materials in orange. Now, the reason for the three-month lag is that typically the industrial materials, this materials price index tends to lead the intermediate materials by about 3 months because you're buying the goods from basically raw materials goods to be turned into intermediate goods.
What's the difference between intermediate materials and...
Okay, so industrial materials price index is going to be, that's the raw material. That's iron ore, okay. That's raw copper.
Commodities.
It's commodities. And then intermediate materials is you've now turned it into something processed. So that is your steel, your copper pipe. And so because of the lead times, if you start seeing a drop-off in the price of the materials 3 months ago, that's going to feed through to a slower price increase in the intermediate goods as they get produced. So the point of the graph is that we're seeing, you know, even in the first parts of 06, that the raw materials price index is beginning to slow. It's not turning negative. It's still a price appreciation, but the rate of increase is slowing.
Right.
And so what's going to happen is that the intermediate materials will also begin to follow suit. And I think, you know, the question is, well, why is oil prices in a construction slide? Well, there's two reasons. One is oil goes into a lot of the things that you want, like PVC pipe, or at least oil eventually gets into them.
Yeah.
And secondly, you have to transport the stuff to your job site. And also, you know, all the machinery that you're running is running on oil, and they've also got, in fact, the third highest cost to a operator of heavy equipment is fuel, after the cost of his equipment and the cost of his labor. So oil prices do matter in terms of the cost of construction. And you know, the bad news is, easing here is a relative term. They're going to come off their peak values of probably this summer, but they're not going to fall off to what we used to see them back in the early part of the decade. And that also holds true for natural gas. And natural gas is important mostly because it's an energy source for refining. So things like copper, aluminum, even some steel are running off natural gas-fired plants. And so those prices are tremendously important. They also power electricity, which in turn powers aluminum production.
Yeah, what is that black line that runs across and steps up?
Okay, the red line is sort of the average price of natural gas. And Henry Hub is a market index, or sorry, it's a market trading term that is commonly used in natural gas.
Okay.
But essentially think about, I guess, the overall stock market compared to the Dow Jones. You know, what can be more volatile than the other? The average is basically taking an average over the time frame. So we've averaged out the highs and the lows. I didn't see what I made for a moving average, but we've essentially said over the past 4 years, the average price was this, and this is how things have moved around it.
Right.
The idea was to show that there's a permanent shift in the cost of natural gas going, we think, forward. And some of that's because of certain hurricanes, that some of those rigs aren't online and will not come back online in the near future.
Haven't they lost like 15% of their total capacity?
Exactly. I mean, some of the rigs were damaged. Those can be fixed, but they also had some damage to lines on the ocean floor, and those simply can't be fixed in what we're looking at for out a year or two in the forecast.
Right.
And also, just as an economy, we've become less enamored of oil as a fuel for power plants and for homes, and we like natural gas. It's cleaner. So we also increase demand in a sort of a permanent fashion.
Right.
Because once you've installed your new power plant or your new furnace, you're stuck with it for 20 years. So between a combination of lost supply and a change in demand patterns, we've got a permanently higher cost for natural gas. PVC pipe is, again, driven by demand and also by the cost of materials, which is largely fuel. We do expect to have high prices through next year. Now, you've got a little bit higher production than you had last year because we have brought plants online in the Gulf after the hurricanes. Home building is, in fact, settling down, so that removes some demand. However, we've got higher prices for both ethylene and chlorine, and we also have growing non-residential construction market, which will take up some of the slack for home building. And, of course, there is rebuilding from Hurricane Katrina in the Gulf, which, while overall housing starts are going to drop, there will be definitely some stronger-than-average spending in the Gulf area to rebuild, certainly in 06 and somewhat in 07. Now, the good news here is that once you get past 2007, we have potential sharp price correction, and that means downward, because there will be more plants coming online, both in North America and also in Asia, which largely means China. Steel markets absolutely just exploded in late 2004. Some of that was real. Some of that was just the lack of a true steel trading index. You can't buy steel futures. So when prices start to go up, you've got to jump on board, make sure you get your contract at that price, and you get a little bit of panic buying in steel that you don't see in some other commodities. But you can see that also that was the time when we had a combination of strong residential and non-residential growth in our economy, and also, in fact, very, very strong consumer spending. When you buy a new house, you also buy the new washer and dryer, and those are all fashioned out of cold-rolled steel or hot-rolled steel as well. So we see this price increase through 2005. It's begun to decline late last year. It's been a blip again this year. But we are looking at something that is moderated to compare to recent history, but stronger than we have had in most of the decade.
Why are U.S. prices so much higher than the rest of the world?
It's part of it is just our own capacity, but part of it also is China has been growing. And we have a lot of imports of steel from China. What we're now seeing is a U.S. capacity that hasn't grown, and China's capacity being used by China. So we can't import as much as we used to. We have a high demand here. In fact, in one sense, the change to non-res from residential does push steel. I mean, we do steel structurally in houses to some degree, but not to a great degree compared to most non-res construction. So in some respects, the pickup of non-res is going to push up steel prices more than, say, lumber or other traditional or home-building kinds of materials.
Don't they have tariffs on imported steel, too?
Yes, they do.
That's got to affect that, I would think.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I know that if we get to cement, there's been some issues with cement in Mexico. I'm not sure about steel.
I think there is. I have a friend who's in the steel business.
And I think we did have some issues with China. That was one of the points of the visit when the chairman came to the U.S. I think steel tariffs was on the agenda. In fact, when we do this presentation for pure cost clients, we actually refer to China as the 800-pound gorilla. And there's a slide which shows King Kong on the Empire State Building. And because so much of the demand for these materials is driven by what does China do? What do they demand? What do they build for capacity? And they are so large in the market, and their plants are so large, that they can distort prices quite quickly. That's sort of the timeline of what moves metals prices.
Yeah, I think it's pretty interesting.
Yeah, I'm not sure it has lots of discussion of particular construction materials, but it does show that, in fact, as the next slide says, prices are insane in metals right now. And if you look at history, and if you look at past crises, we're high compared to any of those previous crises. So we do forecast a correction in sort of the base metals. And base metals I'm referring to here for construction are primarily copper and aluminum. So how ridiculous can things get? Well,
copper really affects us in hotels because of all the wiring.
Exactly.
All the plumbing and all the mechanical equipment that's using copper.
Right, and aluminum also typically is used for the windows and door frames and the curtain wall in the higher-rise hotels. So both those commodities are pretty important. And copper is, in fact, insane right now. I went to Home Depot to buy a simple piece of pipe to replace a section of my basement, and I was stunned at what they're getting for an 8-foot section of pipe. But, fundamentally, we do have low inventories. It has been slow to ramp up new production because, let's face it, this is a volatile business, and nobody wants to ramp up new production immediately based upon a couple months of perceived demand. You add to that the fact that China has been gobbling up lots of base metals for their own manufacturing economy, and you have concerns about possible supply disruptions because this stuff tends to come from parts of the world that aren't terribly stable, largely places in Africa in this case, and somewhat South America. And of course, another copper producer is Australia, and much of their copper is right now going to China, not to the U.S., so it limits the number of supply. However, looking in the longer term, and in fact even the near term, high prices are reducing consumption, and clearly prices will drive more production to come online. And production does not mean new plants. There are plants that have, you know, got idle capacity that you can ramp up without spending 2-3 years to build a whole new plant. So near term, you can get production online. And so this next slide shows what we think happens to copper prices. And in fact, that even now, because of the high price, the demand for copper is coming in line with supply. And if you look at that curve, you look at past history, you see exactly why producers aren't always thrilled at capacity. Because as soon as there's that gap between supply and demand and you want to ramp up, you always ramp up too much, and then you end up driving prices down. So
it's the same thing with hotel development. You start developing when the market is good, and you open when it tanks.
Exactly. So the price, we think copper is going to come into line in terms of ease in price because it's coming into line with supply and demand. Cement prices actually were pretty high in 2005. They were good if you were a producer. They were not good if you were a buyer. The good news is that we're adding more capacity, most of which comes around next year. This is where we had the nice news that basically says that Mexico was, I believe, over-tariffing their cement, so we actually get extra cement from Mexico. China's been adding capacity like crazy. They've been adding more capacity than they can possibly use, so we have the probability of increased imports from China coming forward. Of course, that comes with a cost, too. It only makes sense to import something that bulky and that heavy when prices are high, but prices are so high that it makes sense to import it and then reduce the prices somewhat. And then longer term, we're just looking at slower demand growth as construction eases off. So the whole thing is, taken together, shows up the next graph that price increase is looking at about 10% this year, but the trend is toward a more sustainable level of price that we've seen over the past decade. And we're on the last couple slides here. One is ocean-going freight. As Martin alluded to, there's been a softening in that market, even with energy prices being high. There's just a more efficient shipping mechanism than it used to be even a couple of years ago. And you also add to that, not only the bigger ships, but also just improved ports. You can offload the stuff faster. So we don't think that freight costs will be as high as they have been the past couple of years. But even so, if you compare it to stuff back in the, this is index, so it's adjusted for inflation, prices are going to be much higher than they were in the early part of the decade. It's something that we have to live with in the future. And the final slide is talking about a correction of wallboard prices. This is, wallboard is also called sheetrock. And the good news here is that prices are going to come down quite quickly this year. In fact, might see some price declines. That's because housing is one of the bigger components of wallboard demand. So when that falls off, it has a much quicker and larger impact on wallboard than it does on things like cement and steel. I need to work in two more items. One is lumber, because that's another story of, I think it's important to hotels. It'll be very similar to the other ones. In fact, it'll be similar to wallboard, in that we have a tremendous price increases in 2005, 18-20% in lumber and plywood. And then it falls off dramatically in 2006. And the third thing I want to do is something with labor.
Can I ask you about that?
Yeah, I've got one slide that looks at just sort of U.S. construction wages compared to total wages. And you see that construction wages actually have lagged total wage growth for most of this decade.
It's surprising. It hasn't been much of a factor.
There is a blip in 2005. When housing really took off, so the good news was typically in this decade, housing has been increasing while non-res has been relatively weak.
Right.
Even when it's been growing, it's been at a relatively low level. And what happened last year is you really begin to see a pickup in certain kinds of non-res construction, not so much hotels necessarily, but in office particular, and some retail. So we begin to have this coinciding of both non-res and residential demand. So we have a period of late 2005 to late 2004 into 2005, where prices are higher for construction labor than for most of the economy, but the forecast brings them down quite quickly in 2006. What I'm looking at, going through the various states and looking at, we don't have a metro forecast for construction labor costs. We do have one by state. Now, that's, I think, of some interest to people at this meeting, and of course, you can only put so much information on one graph where it just looks absolutely, you can't read it.
Right.
And I'm just trying to pick which stories I want to tell. There's, if you're hotel builders, I think you care a whole lot about New York, California, Hawaii, Florida, the certain tourist and business destinations that you worry about. And then there are other stories where Nevada is another one I think you'd worry about. But some of the really strong growth in the economy is coming in places like Idaho, Montana. Well, Alaska is one that, because of energy, I would discount that for this audience. Louisiana because of the hurricane. I discount that as well for this audience. If you show a U.S. average and you show four states, you've really pretty well maxed out what a graph can show. So you want to pick a couple that are above average, a couple that are below average, and make a story.
The only other parts, is that the end of yours then, Scott?
Yeah, that is the end, yeah.
Okay. There's two other categories. I haven't added the backup slide. Technology in hotels is getting to be more important because the operation is getting more complex, especially where they're mixed use or resorts or timeshare fractional. You can buy more functionality for less money today because of the advances in technology, adding more systems. So the net effect is that category is going up about 10%, but people are doing more. OS&E is down about 5%. It's really insignificant. And then contingencies are a favorite topic because that's always something easy for people to cut to get budgets to work out. And the only thing I would recommend there is that I'm probably going to give them some ranges for types of projects, renovations, redevelopment, and ground up for what I would recommend that they use for contingencies. And we can talk about that also. And then for the recommendations, I think we should conclude this on, okay, now that we know all this stuff, what do you do? You know, I think that, I mean, like for us, we're going into a lot of ground up development now for mixed use projects where it's hotel, condo, retail. And the reason we're doing that is that the markets are very strong. Where we're doing it, the land is very expensive and construction costs are very expensive. So we're teaming up with local developers who already own land, basically residential developers, that want to create some differentiation for their condominium by associating with a hotel. We want to do the same thing from our side, and when we team up, the economics work better. So, you know, when I see, you know, residential sales falling off, it concerns me a little bit, but I think that the way we're doing it hopefully will be insulated because of the strength of the market and the fact we're offering a unique product. Yeah, so now the next question is, what do we do now?
What do we do now? I think what we do now is honestly go back to basics the way we did it about 20 years ago, John, and it's if we can just slow the process, the team gets to know each other. You'll have a kickoff meeting, which we used to have, and everyone knows everybody, and everyone's role is defined, and the rules of the game can be established, like design to the budget. Here is a real budget from the owner, not a fantasy budget that's artificially lowered, but here's the real budget we have to work with. Your task is to bring the design into the budget, and when you make a presentation, whether it be preliminary or final, you will bring your best guess on a line item basis what all of these things are going to cost. You know, so many times all of this Hollywood slideshows and toasting and did these presentations without a purchasing agent involved, and everyone's very pleased with it, and very cursory, do you think we're in budget? Yeah, I think we probably are. And then you find out about 99 times out of 100, no, you're not in budget, and then frustration sets in and so forth. So if they can discipline themselves to bring the budget with them, they don't have to break it down to scotch guarding and whatnot, but the sofa we think is going to be $1,000 and the chair is going to be $500 or something, just to give them some idea that that presentation is validated to the budget. I think if you would, again, bring the purchasing guy in earlier, we're typically brought in, after everything has been approved, if we can be brought in during that process, maybe we can help say, guys, it looks like we're out of line here. Why don't we, make some adjustments going in? If we can commit orders earlier, as I mentioned earlier in this conversation, every factory would lower their prices if we can allow them to produce in their slow time. We've had great success with that. What I'm suggesting is if you can issue the order, something is going to take 12 to 16 weeks on a normal schedule, give it twice that, or three times that if you can. The more you can allow that, several things happen. You lock in on your pricing, and you give them a time to develop the product during slow times.
Right. I agree with you with all that.
Not every project has to be custom. Not every room in the planet Earth has to start from scratch. Use a lamp that you've developed before. Use an entire room that you've developed before. And two things happen there. The quantity goes up, so it's a bigger, more negotiable nut to keep the pricing down on. And you reduce purchasing fees, you reduce design fees, you reduce the executive time to approve and tweak and shop drawings and all of that stuff. On the other hand, if you go in panicked, as most of my projects are, the factories know this,
Yeah.
The factories hear this. The ocean freight people, I mean, and the air freight people particularly, love it. They'll take advantage of you. It's supply and demand, and they're in demand, so you're going to pay through the nose. And the irony is we sit here and we talk about the cost of a fabric or the cost of a chair or the lamp, which was $100, really ought to be $80, and then we'll spend $100 just getting it there.
That's crazy.
And, you know, and so why compromise the quality if you take your time, put it on a slow boat from China, literally, and save the money? So,
okay, why don't we wrap it up? First, I appreciate everybody's contributions, and, you know, it's helped me. I hope it's helped some other folks here.